Hello and welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast, your source for rants, raves, and puns from Tech Freedom, your Washington, D.C. advocate for the freedom to invest, tinker, innovate, and play in space. I'm Darren Soka, Tech Freedom President, and I'm here today interviewing Jim Dunstan, adjunct fellow here at Tech Freedom and founder of Mobius Legal Group. So Jim, I've dabbled in space law for a decade with you. We've done a lot of things together. But you're actually a space lawyer. You've been doing space law for how long?
33 years now.
So when you tell people that you're a space lawyer, like at cocktail parties or family talk, what do people say?
Well, they usually ask how much per square foot a lease is in downtown Washington, D.C., and I have to stop and say, no, not that kind of space. I'm talking about the outer space, the space up above us. And then usually at a cocktail party, they'll turn immediately and walk away.
But some people must find that cool, right?
No, they do. A lot of people do find it pretty cool. A lot of people then say, well, what the heck is that? What is space law? And then I usually, bore them with a 4 or 5 minute explanation of things like the Outer Space Treaty and stuff like that. But mainly what I tell them is outer space law is just the same as Earth law in terms of what I do for my clients, because they have legal needs for contracts, intellectual property, export, ITAR, those types of issues. And that's generally the types of things that I spend most of my time doing. We get to have some fun on the policy side, you and I, when we talk about legislation and things like that. But day to day, it's the same sort of issues that any company has in terms of their legal needs.
Well, we're going to do a series of interviews, and we're going to unpack some of those policy issues about space property rights and space mining and so on. But today, I just want you to introduce what space law is, how you got into it, and for those of us in the audience who might be thinking about careers in space law, anything you can do to dissuade them from taking on that hopeless task.
Yes, I'll definitely emphasize that. So I'll start with sort of how I got into it. So I looked around and said, well, what interests me? And what interested me then was computers and outer space. I was, I grew up a nerd. Oh yeah, absolutely. Grew up an orphan of Apollo, as we like to call ourselves, of that generation that watched, Neil and Buzz walk on the moon and drank the Kool-Aid that we all would be going soon and that there was going to be a vibrant economy in space. And so I'd always loved the space program. And I had an older brother who was very much an engineer and went to the Air Force Academy and was a career pilot from the Air Force. And so I was steeped in that stuff growing up. And so I get into law school, I get totally bored, I look around, and lo and behold, Georgetown had a class on space law. And I said, well, I'll take this. And so I took that, and I also started taking a lot of technology, intellectual property cases, as well as communications, because I've always been sort of a tech head, and I'm not an engineer by training, but I pick engineering things up very, very quickly. So I took the space law class and just absolutely fell in love with it. It was wild. I went on, became the founder of the Georgetown Space Law Group, which I believe was the first law school student organization in the country. And now there's bunches of them, and we have the Montford Locks Space Law Moot Court competition, and but back then nobody even thought about
that's space a competition law. Today where law students sit around and argue space law cases.
Space law cases. So the other thing I did was I started writing computer games. I had a classmate at Georgetown, and he and I started writing computer games for the then right-out-of-the-box IBM PC, the very, very first versions of it, and the Apple II as well. He went on to become a very, very successful and famous computer game author and is still my oldest and longest client and very, very close friend. I took this space law class. I wrote computer games, and so in 1983, I graduated from Georgetown with my law degree with a specialty in outer space law and computer game law. And when I interviewed with a lot of the firms around, they said, wow, that's really interesting stuff, but we don't do any of that. And so I was very, very fortunate. I ended up at a small boutique communications firm called Haley Bader & Potts. And it turns out that Haley, of Haley, Bader, and Potts, was Andrew G. Haley, who was the world's first space lawyer. And when they interviewed me to be a communications associate, they said, well, my writing sample was a law review article on the geostationary orbit that I'd written and was being published at the time. And they looked at it and they went, really? You want to do space law? We haven't done any of that since Halley died back in 1966. But they said, that's great. You know, why don't you do it? So I was very, very fortunate to come out of law school, go into a firm where they supported you know, what I wanted to do.
So you have real clients today in space. Who are they and what do they do?
I'm currently working with a client at the FCC. They want to launch a constellation of CubeSats to do weather monitoring. And so we're dealing with the FCC on...
And a CubeSat is...
A CubeSat is a very, very small satellite. They range a 1U, one-unit CubeSat is 10 centimeters per side and has to be less than 1 kilogram. So these satellites are what are known as 6U. So there's 6 satellites, 2x3 configuration. But it's still less than a foot and a half, 2 feet. And yet... The technology is so good now, the miniaturization of sensors and everything that you can do with these satellites today, what would take something the size of a school bus 20 years ago. And so we're working, but and they're very cheap too. They're, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars rather than tens and hundreds of millions of dollars. And we'll get into that in a later podcast, the issues that are confronting the FCC, how do they deal with all these constellations of CubeSats running around. So I do that. I do ITAR,
which is the
International Trades in Arms Regulations. And you know, the quick deal there was a Chinese rocket launch that went bad along March 3 back in the 90s. Engineers being engineers, they tried to be helpful, and basically they told the Chinese what was wrong with their rocket, and of course the Chinese rocket is the same thing as an ICBM. Lots of people on the Hill got really, really mad at that, and so they pretty much shut down the ability of anybody in the United States to be able to talk to anybody in a foreign country. And so there are very, very strict regulations on the export of space technologies and items to foreign entities, and so I help my clients sort of navigate those waters. It's possible to do it. You can get a license, but it's tedious, it's expensive to do. I've got clients that have intellectual property needs. Very interesting questions revolving around...
No pun intended.
Revolving around, yes. The question of IP as it relates to things that are manufactured in space, things that are 3D printed in space. If an item is 3D printed in space, is it exported for purposes of the ITAR? So the, you know, very interesting issues related to intellectual property and export of sort of the next generation of manufacturing in space. And so I've got some clients I'm dealing with that. So it's a wide variety.
So you're most famous for negotiating the first private lease in space. What was that about?
So back in the 90s, there was a telecom exec who was quite wealthy, and he saw an opportunity with the Russian Mir space station, which was sitting in orbit vacant because the Russians had basically run out of money to run it, and they were also participating in the first part of building the International Space Station. And so he approached the RSG Energia, the big Russian aerospace contractor, and said, would they be interested in selling the facility? And at first they said, well, no, we can't sell the facility. And they had basically taken ownership of it from Roscosmos, the Russian space agency, because Roscosmos didn't have any money to pay the RSC Energia. And so in exchange, they sort of took ownership of a manned space station, you know, that was sitting there vacant. And they said, well, we can't sell it to you, but we probably could do a lease. And so he turned to me and said, we need to do a lease, and I want it to be simple. I don't want it to be, you know, hundreds of pages. I don't want it to be like a NASA contract. And so I scratched my head and went to the form books in the library and said, huh. And I pulled down a residential apartment lease, and I used that as the form. And the lease literally states, you know, the Mir space station, you know, which is currently situated at orbital inclination, this and this altitude, and it was a very simple sort of apartment lease. And so when they got over to Russia to negotiate, they slid this thing across the table, and it was only about 5 pages long. And the head of RSC Energia looks at it and goes, you know, what is this? What is this? And so my client, you know, leaned over and looked him straight in the eye and said, it's an apartment lease five rooms, beautiful views. And his English was good, but he waited for the Russian translation of it, and he threw back his head and laughed, and from there we were off to the races. So we did, we did a lease for the Mir space station. There was a launch of a crew that went there to do the refurb on it, and things were going along very well, nicely on it, until the United States government decided that they didn't want any competition for the International Space Station, and basically twisted the arms of the Russians to have them deorbit and dump it into the Pacific Ocean.
And how did they do that legally?
It wasn't legal. And there was nothing legal about it. It was all political. It was all arm twisting, machinations at the very political level.
But didn't they use those international traffic in arms regulations you mentioned to block the export of a specific technology?
Right, and so we developed a technology to boost the Mir space station using electromagnetic tethers, which are the closest thing to magic I've ever been able to figure. Essentially, if you have a long wire in space and you run electrons down it, you electrify it, it turns into propulsion. And so we had this thing developed. It was ready to go, and so we went and for an ITAR license, export license for the thing, and it sat. And it sat, and it sat. And then miraculously, the day after Mir was plunked down into the Pacific Ocean, we got our license to export the tether to send it to Mir, which, of course, was now at the bottom of the ocean.
And not coincidentally, NASA actually had a role in that approval process by the State Department.
According to the ITAR regulations, yes. Any ITAR license goes through NASA as well as the State Department and Department of Defense.
So two lessons there. One, politics doesn't end in orbit. It just keeps going and people keep playing bullshit political games. Mm. And two, the special genius of your approach to space law is, sounds like simplicity, using for the Mir space station, a Mir apartment lease.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
In other words, sometimes the best solution is not a fancy different one. Sometimes it's existing legal forms, extending traditional law into space.
And especially things that we understand and know, and so we don't confuse ourselves with complexity when it's not necessary.
Like private property, for example.
Yeah, exactly. We'll get to that.
We're going to unpack that later, but I did want to ask about two other things you've done. So also first pitch thrown from space for a World Series game. You were the lawyer on that deal.
Right. So in 2002, let's talk about the commercial first, because it kind of leads into that if I can. So,
okay, first commercial from the moon. Let's talk about that.
Well, first commercial from the International Space Station. I was working for a company. I was a founder of a company called Lunacorp, and I was also their lawyer, and which had planned a private mission to the moon for a rover, sort of what the XPRIZE, Google Lunar XPRIZE has turned into be, but this is long before that came about. It's 2000. And we had as a sponsor Radio Shack. The day that Radio Shack announced its sponsorship of Lunacorp to go to the moon, their stock rose 6% on a day that the Dow went down 4%. And we actually tracked that the value of that to Radio Shack was worth tens of millions of dollars. So anyway, the first thing that Radio Shack wanted to do is see if we could do a commercial on the ISS. And so we worked our channels within NASA, and ultimately NASA said, well, no, we can't have our astronauts doing commercials for Radio Shack. We can't do it. So we ended up going through the Russians. And I used some of my old connections from the Mir days to find the people within the Russian Space Agency to see if they would essentially rent out their cosmonauts to do a commercial. And we reached an agreement. We did it. And it was for Radio Shack. It was for a talking picture frame for Father's Day. And we got it. Had it tested, the picture frame, and we literally had to blow a few of them up to show that NASA that they wouldn't blow up on their own. And this is a little piece of plastic with a battery in it, and the idea is you record a message. And so we used Yuri Yusevich on the second expedition crew, and sent up the talking picture frame, and they did about 7 or 8 minutes of footage. I still have the raw footage. It is the funniest thing because they're talking Russian the whole time. And then we're talking Russian, and then you hear Radio Shack, as they were doing it. And then so we filmed this thing, then brought the tape back down to Earth The other funny story in that was the day that they were going to film the thing in on the space station, suddenly one of the in-house Radio Shack lawyers woke up in a cold sweat and apparently says, do we have a model release, you know, a spokesman release from the astronaut? And we're like, no, he's on orbit. And they're saying, well, we can't use this unless you can get a release from him. So I wrote up a model lease, and it was faxed up to the space station. And Yuri signed it, and so it's the first contract ever executed on orbit as well. And so they filmed the commercial. We brought the tape back down, but we knew, it landed in Kazakhstan. And oh, by the way, this was all shot while Dennis Tito was up on the space station. And we firmly...
That was the first space tourist.
As Dennis Tito, the first space tourist. And we firmly believe the only reason we sort of got away with this was we flew under the radar because all of NASA's eyes were watching Tito in the module next door while the Russian guys are off filming this commercial in another module. They filmed the commercial. The release was rubber banded around the cassette, the digital cassette that was brought back down. But we knew that the crew landing in Kazakhstan, everything was going to be impounded. And so we had to get Yuri to put it in as his personal collection. He then handed it off to somebody else, who then we had to get it back to the United States. And understand, this is now 5 days before Father's Day, and the whole commercial was a Father's Day commercial of these talking picture frames. And so we found a pilot to take the cassette to New York, and then we flew to New York and literally got it from him. I don't know the legality on that, but the statute of limitations, I'm sure, is a run on it. But his only problem was he saw this, what looked like a legal document in Russian, attached to it, and so he crumpled it up and threw it into somewhere in the dumps of Frankfurt, Germany is the first contract that was executed on orbit. So we brought it back. They cut the commercial. Radio Shack then bought spot time on the second NBA final playoff game 3 days before Father's Day to run the spot. So they were paying top dollar. They spent more on that 30-second ad than they spent on actually creating the 30-second ad. So unfortunately, nobody within Radio Shack, other than our marketing guys, thought we were going to be able to pull this off. And so they ended up not stocking the 7,000 Radio Shack stores with very many of these talking picture frames. So the thing airs on a Tuesday night before Father's Day. And by the next day, every single talking picture frame in all 7,000 stores is gone. It's off the shelf. And they have no way to resupply them before Father's Day. And so it was a huge success as a commercial. But it was a huge blunder because there wasn't enough faith that we could pull this off, that they didn't stock enough of these things. The interesting side note is, so we had Yuri's daughter record for him. And oh, by the way, Russians don't celebrate Father's Day. So this was, the whole concept was sort of alien to them. But Jim Voss was the commander of Expedition 2 crew, United States NASA astronaut. And so we had his daughter also record one. And so we brought one up for Jim as well. Because at that time there were only three crew members on ISS. And we later got to know Jim very well. And he said that his most prized possession as a NASA astronaut is that talking picture frame that was sent up by a private entity on board. When the shot was done, before it aired on that Tuesday night, we flew down to Houston and met with the head of the astronauts at NASA. And he pulled in all of the NASA astronauts that he could find and said, we want to show you this. And they showed them the commercial. And the head of the astronauts corps said, could you ever see yourselves doing this type of thing? And to a person, they basically said, blank and A, yes. Why couldn't we have done that? Well, the reason we couldn't do that was because NASA, won't allow its astronauts to do things like this. And so, but we talked to them, well, what if we could do something like that, but that would benefit NASA rather than be, wholly, commercial? And so what we came up with and what Radio Shack came up with was the idea of, let's fly a baseball into outer space, and then let's have...
An export control license.
With an export control license. No, actually, because it was a NASA item. And so NASA...
Oh, so NASA's exempt.
NASA, they're not technically exempt, but somehow they always get around it. And so what we did is we flew to the All-Star game that year was in Milwaukee. And so we had Jim Voss, who's now back down from space. He threw out the first pitch at the Futures game, which is the minor league All-Star game, the day before the real All-Star game. He threw out the first pitch, and that ball was then flown into space. And so we were going to have it, thrown out. Obviously we couldn't throw it out of ISS, and back then they were still very, sort of, ooh, we can't do anything that might damage, the baseball could somehow. So it was essentially just thrown the length of the, of one of the modules. And we got Fox, which was broadcasting the World Series that year, to give Sean O'Keefe, was the NASA administrator then, to give Sean O'Keefe 5 minutes before game one of the World Series to talk about the future of space and the future of NASA. Prime time, huge eyeballs, right? This is going to be the greatest thing. It's the greatest PR. So a week before the game, we've already filmed, because we couldn't do it live, so we filmed it a week before. Suddenly we get a call from NASA. The official World Series program had now been printed. The back cover of it was talking about the first pitch, ISS, NASA, all that stuff. And in the very small corner of it was a Radio Shack logo, because Radio Shack was footing the bill for all this. It was spending all the money. NASA went ballistic, went absolutely bonkers. And John O'Keefe refused to talk to Fox News about the future of NASA, because on the back of the World Series program was a small Radio Shack. At that point, private sector NASA was.
So why the hostility from NASA to private enterprise and advertising and capitalism?
I think at that point, NASA was looking at that opportunity to get in front of the public, but also to get in front of policymakers, to show a vision of NASA going to Mars or wherever the destination was at that point. And I think they felt that having any sort of commercial aspect to it would possibly anger some politicians and anger some of the NASA centers and whatnot. They were looking at that opportunity as a giant advertisement to go get more money from Congress. And I think that just wasn't consistent with having any sort of tie-in with commercialism. Now, again, this is 2002. This is 13 years ago. And NASA has learned its lessons well enough now over the years of having program after program started and then canceled because it was going nowhere. I think they get it now. They understand that there's got to be a partnership with private sector, and certainly what we're seeing with SpaceX and other private companies working with NASA is a testament to that. But back then, it was all government all the time. The private sector has no business doing anything in space.
SpaceX launching, for example, that really changes people's minds, helps them see that there are private companies out there that are doing real, serious rocketry.
And I think not just the fact that they're launching and not just that they're launching for less price than some of the big traditional, but you can't beat video. And you can't beat the video of that first stage coming back in, first crashing and then landing successfully and then crashing again. I mean, it's great eye candy, but what it portends of the future of, in fact, a first stage flyback booster. NASA wanted that for the shuttle back in the 70s, and they had to scrap it because they couldn't figure out how to do it for under multiple billions of dollars. And here you got a guy who's got an existing rocket. He throws legs on the thing. He brings it back down and lands it. I mean, that's been NASA's fantasy for 40 years.
Why does it matter, Jim, that launch costs might fall so much?
Because launch costs are everything if you're talking about a space economy. If launch costs fall, more things can go into space. Plus, if I only have one expensive launch vehicle, then I have to make my satellite that much more expensive, and it's got to last that much longer because I don't get that many shots to go. But if launch are both cheaper and more frequent, that's the other thing, is it every time you build a rocket and throw it away, you have to build another one. You have the life cycle of building those rockets. If you can bring back the first stage and reuse it, that means I can launch both more cheaply and more often. And that's what has the possibility of opening up a true space economy.
Now, we make a point here on the show of not falling into knee-jerk partisanship. So there are many people who take a very hard line here and say that private enterprise is everything, and the Democrats hate private enterprise, and the Republicans are for it. The reality here has been a little more complicated. SpaceX has gotten to where it's gotten in part because it's been essentially providing a commercial service of crew and cargo transportation to the International Space Station in a government contract. So is this good public-private partnership? Well, how much credit should we give the Obama administration here?
Well, I think, I don't know if there's a direct credit toward the Obama administration. The commercial space program from NASA predates his administration. It was around before that. Granted, he's fought to keep the funding for it alive. So yeah, we have to give that credit. But it's been a long time in coming, and so I think you spread the credit around multiple places. But you did bring up a really interesting point, because space is one of those few issues that tend to be way more parochial than we think they should be. In other words, you've got Republicans supporting the space launch system, this giant boondoggle costing billions of dollars because it supports a particular member's constituency. And that's the unfortunate part about space politics. It's driven much more by the fact that there are NASA centers in places where congressmen are going to fight for them, be they Democrats or be they Republicans.
So what do you think makes the people inside NASA, the Obama political appointees who've pushed for these commercial programs, for the new NASA, for supporting companies like SpaceX, for being a good customer, what do you think motivates them?
I think what motivates them is seeing multiple generations of failure at NASA. We talked about all these, the programs, the Constellation program, all these programs that cost billions of dollars that were started and then never developed into anything and had to be canceled because they were too expensive if you were talking about doing it the old traditional way. And one thing that that's really important to keep in mind, yes, SpaceX is getting money from the government to supply the ISS, but the contract under which SpaceX is doing this is far different from the FARs.
Federal Acquisition
Regulations.
Regulations.
Exactly. It's a streamlined, stripped-down contract that SpaceX has, which means the cost of administering that contract is far less than it would be in a normal NASA acquisition. And so I think that's the greatest victory here, is not just SpaceX providing private services, because it's done under a streamlined regulatory regime, which makes it that much cheaper to do it.
You just wrote a book, so you're now a space novelist in addition to a space lawyer.
Well, it's even worse than that. I'm a science fiction novelist. It's not like it was a serious space. I do plenty of writing on serious space issues in law review articles, but I actually put fingers to typewriters and wrote a science fiction novel called Atlantis Ascending. It is available on Amazon.com in both ebook, and you can get a hard copy. Or if you go to my website at newspacefiction.com, that's all one word, newspacefiction.com, has both a link to Amazon, or you can buy a copy directly from me, and I'll sign it for you.
And I read the book, and I thought it was rollicking good fun. Are we going to see more space law in your new novels?
Actually, both my second and third, which are about two-thirds done each, have some significant space law issues in them, as well as good rollicking fun.
Well, Jim Dunstan, adjunct fellow here at Tech Freedom, founder of Mobius Legal Group, available for hire as a private commercial space lawyer and budding sci-fi novelist. Thank you for joining us today. We'll have you back on the show to get into some of the policy issues that we touched on briefly today, but didn't really unpack.
Thank you, Baron. It's been a pleasure.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit, tax-exempt think tank based in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work in tech policy and for more episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.